Hey everybody, this is Pierre Quinn and you're listening to the Leading While Green podcast, where my mission is to help you live, learn, and lead with confidence. On this episode, I am joined by the former director of performance for the New York Yankees, Coach Dana Cavalia. Coach Cavalia is the author of the new book, Habits of a Champion. Nobody becomes a champion by accident. And in our conversation today, we talk about what it takes to form and keep a championship culture in our organizations. We have a great conversation, so listen up. Before we hop into the conversation with Coach Cavalia, I just want to thank you for supporting the Leading While Green podcast. You're posting all over social media. You're texting and emailing, sending people links to your favorite episodes. And I thank you so much. Now, what I could use are a few more reviews on iTunes, 5-star reviews and some comments. Let people know your favorite episode. Let them know how you've been impacted by this podcast and how it supported you on your leadership journey. Also want to encourage you to stop by PRCQuinn.com and do three things. Number one, sign up for my leaders list to make sure you get the email notifications before anybody else knows what's going on. You will know what's going on. The second thing is I want you to take my free course, 12 Ways to Grow as a Leader. Free course, 4-part video series, practical, actionable advice that you can use right now to grow your leadership. And the third thing is I want you to get your hands on, get your eyes on my leadership intensive, my Leading While Green leadership intensive. You need this as you're ending 2018 and going into 2019 and you want to be a better leader or you want to coach up some people on your leadership team. Make sure you get my Leading While Green leadership intensive. Practical, actionable, dynamic video lessons, 48-page study guide, stuff that I've shared in keynotes and workshops and seminars with leadership teams across the country. I distilled it down and I want to put it in your hands. So make sure that you get it. Okay, my guest today, Coach Dana Cavalia, highly sought after, high performance coach. Now, the majority of Coach Cavalia's career has been with the New York Yankees. In fact, in 2009, as a director of performance, he led the team to a World Series championship. And in that year, he was voted by his peers as the top strength and conditioning coach, in Major League Baseball. And he was the recipient that year of the Nolan Ryan Award. Now, currently, in addition to working with athletes, he works with coaches, he works with CEOs, he works with executives, and he travels as a speaker, helping others optimize their overall performance through his 5 drivers of performance framework. Here's my conversation with Coach Dana Cavalia. To be joined by Coach Dana Cavalia on this episode of the Leading While Green podcast. Coach is an international speaker. He's a highly sought after performance coach. He is the former director of performance for the New York Yankees and the author of the new book, Habits of a Champion. Nobody becomes a champion by accident. Coach, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So, Coach, give us a bit of your backstory. When did you first fall in love with sports and you knew you wanted to do this for the rest of your life?
Yeah, you know, for me, it was when I first started playing baseball as a young guy. And, you know, stepping on that field for the first time and, yeah, making contact with a ball and watching how far it went, that was somewhat addicting for me. So that's where it really started, was just, you know, as a young guy, you know, getting on the field. It was baseball. I didn't really like any other sports. I tried most of them and I realized baseball definitely had my heart. So that grabbed me early and I stayed with it and I was able to make a career out of it.
So at what point in your career did you realize that, okay, maybe it's time for me to transition to coaching? Were you known as a go-to guy when you were playing the game? Did people come to you for advice? Did some of your coaches say, I think you should join the coaching ranks one day? What were the indicators that you were going to have a pretty illustrious coaching career?
Yeah, for me, it really started, you know, I was pretty good self-assessing where I was at, what I was doing, and kind of how I fit in to whatever I was doing, whether it was the team or I was able to really look at my own talent set as a guy in college. And I said, you know what, although I love playing ball and, you know, playing in college is cool, I'm not getting to the next level. I just don't have the skills to get to that next level. I pretty much went as far as I can go. I always loved the training. I always say I got into coaching because I was an underperforming player. And I realized that through training, I was able to take my game to the next level. My next level was playing in college. But rather than go through all 4 years of playing, I made a decision and I said, I actually love the training more so than I love the playing. So, you know, I started to help other, you know, other athletes, you know, with the training. And then I started to actually work with the football team at the University of South Florida and, you know, got to know those athletes. And I said, man, you know, this is pretty cool. I get to work with athletes from all different sports. I get to help them improve their performance. And really, I'm not being judged based on my performance as a player anymore. I said, I kind of like this. I could do this for a long time. And really, my journey started. I was an intern with the Yankees at 19 years old. I was interning with the football team at the University of South Florida. And a lot of working for free, a lot of experimenting. And I was able to really dig into my career path. I had nothing to lose. You know, I was 19 years old. I had, you know, the typical college experience. I had no money and I had everything to gain. So I just tried to learn as much as I could. And fortunately, I got to learn on high ticket players like Derek Jeter and A-Rod and players like that. That's how I got that's where I learned. And I just got better as I went. And I always felt called to coaching. Both my parents are teachers. And I saw the response that they got from their students. And I always admired that. And I said, you know, I don't want to go teach in a school and deal with, you know, the typical school setting and the bureaucracy of school. Mm-hmm. Let me go into sport where I can be myself more and not feel, you know, inhibited in any way. So sport got my heart. The players I got to share a lot of time with and help them develop. And that was my journey to coaching.
Coach, one of the drivers of performance that you teach and is part of your curriculum is this idea that high performers need the right mindset. Now, what type of mindset does it take to be able to embrace, for someone whose dream is to play baseball, to embrace, okay, I've reached my peak, I've reached my max, and I now have to embrace, if I'm going to stay with my love of the game, I have to do it in this way, not being on the field as a player, but on the field as a coach and a mentor. And we find that maybe some people with a passion for the game or any sport can't make that transition of accepting that they've reached their max. Talk to us about the mindset that you needed and how you walked yourself through accepting and embracing the transition that you needed to make.
Yeah. Well, you know, I feel like everybody has gifts in their own right. And for me, one of my gifts, and I consider it that, sometimes it's a curse, is just the ability to be ultra real with others. And that's, you know, really important in coaching and most importantly with myself. You know, I had to look in the mirror and say, come on, man, like, are you going to fake this dream and actually think you're going to get there when you know, you just know in your heart that you gave it everything you had. And there wasn't anything, you know, you weren't making any more gains. So you were at the top. You peaked for yourself in terms of your performance. And then you look in the mirror and say, hey, all right, accept that. And now let's move on. I mean, you see so many people even in business. They'll go bankrupt before they quit. And it's like, just quit. It didn't work. Keep moving. And I think the ability to be real with yourself. And, you know, I see it too. You know, when you go into social media channels, you know, there's people that are dead broke that just keep posting and they just keep posting and they don't get the fact that, you know what, maybe this isn't your thing and you actually have to go get a job and work and build yourself to make a living. And you could do this for fun, but you got to have those real moments in your life where you have that honest conversation and that honest dialogue and realize that honesty is the best thing you got. And you got to, you know, go with it. And so the ability to be real with myself and not lie to myself is really something that I've grown to like about myself.
So talk to us, and I want to come back and spend a lot of time on this, on the Yankees conversation. Yeah. But before we go there, talk to us about how you transitioned from high performance coaching and working with some of the top athletes in the world to now working with CEOs and corporate leaders, and what have been some of the similarities and differences between working with people in that arena versus working with professional athletes?
Yeah. So, you know, yesterday I did a workshop. I had 17 CEOs and executives that I was working with, and I opened up and I said, listen, do you guys know what the most competitive sport in the world is? And they said, soccer and baseball. I said, no, it's business. The greatest minds in the world are playing the sport. Some of the most innovative people are playing the sport of business. You're going up against, it's a world's game, and you're going up against the best. Are you prepared to play? And the biggest thing when I speak to companies and I speak to leaders and I speak at conferences, I say, listen, you got to be prepared to play the sport of business. It's a 24/7, 365 game, and that's what it's become. And the question is, are you prepared to play that game? Are you prepared to fly across the country and come back and sit at your desk and work the next day? Like, can you handle that? Do you know how to fuel yourself appropriately so you don't feel fatigued and jet lagged? Are you putting the time into building your physicality? Are you putting boundaries around yourself so you can actually, you know, take care of yourself and put yourself in the first position rather than having everybody pull from you and take from you? So what I found is athletes do an amazing job of putting themselves first and realizing, hey, if I have to train, and because I train myself mentally and physically, I can get to the next level. In business, people just play till they burn out, and they don't have the strategies that we arm our athletes with to get, you know, sustainable performance over the short and long term. So that's why there's, you know, the buzzword of work-life balance, mm-hmm. and you know, all this worksite wellness. But the reality is, it's just, you have to train the individual. And that's what we do a really great job of with the athletes. We get them to, we teach them to know themselves, feel their body, know what's going on in their body, in their mind. When stress comes, what do? How do you handle it? You know, when you're feeling fatigued, how do you get more energy out of yourself without compromising yourself? So all these different strategies athletes have understood for years, and we've coached them on. But in the world of business, it doesn't truly exist. Hmm. And, so many businesses, even these people I was doing a workshop with yesterday, they put the business ahead of everything. You know, the first thing they do is sacrifice themselves. And it's great. And it's very selfless. But I always say you got to be selfish to be selfless. So you got to put yourself in the right position for success. And that's really what I spend a lot of time doing now is educating leaders on how to actually be performance leaders and how they can take care of themselves and get the most out of themselves and their companies.
There's this adage, and I don't know who originally came up with it, but that says something along the lines of we never really rise to the level of the occasion. We actually only fall to the level of our training.
Right.
Speak to us about, you know, being in a professional championship culture, and how true or not true is that adage that we use a lot?
Yeah, well, we would always say, or I would always say, I'd always tell my guys, listen, we're going to out-train the sport of baseball. So if the demands of the sport, is here, we're going to go above that. And that way the game is not going to surprise us. It's not going to shock us. And we'll never have to question our physicality. We'll never have to question our readiness or our preparedness. So when we get out to the field that day, and Roger Clemens actually told me this, he said, Dee, if I train hard and I get my reps in during the week, mm-hmm. when I go out to pitch, I have to focus on one thing, pitching. He goes, but I'll never question my preparedness to play the game. I'll never question my readiness. It'll always be there. And I make sure of that on the 4 days I have between each start. So, you know, it allows him to feel prepared, but rather than prepared and ready, it's confidence. And what do you need to succeed in anything in life? You need confidence. And there's a lot of battered souls out there that are faking it. And when you see somebody that has real confidence and you see someone that's faking it, the guy that has real confidence will bulldoze that other person. And it happens in matchups and sports all the time.
Another driver of performance, and you have five of them on your platform: mindset, training, fueling, recovery, and influence. I think these are awesome. One of the aspects of preparedness and training you talk about in your book is the ability to self-assess and be self-aware. And you tell this neat story about an exchange between you and the captain, between you and Derek Jeter, and how that pointed out some defensiveness for you and then some lessons for all leaders based on that exchange. Tell us that story, and how can we as leaders use that to improve our leadership?
Yeah, you know, so for me being a coach, right, earlier I alluded to, I had a strong ability to self-assess and also assess others. That was my job, identify weakness and correct. That's how I was trained. But sometimes too, there are instances in your life as you're going through things and you think you got it, that you actually don't have it as much as you think you do. So, you know, there was a game, we were in Detroit, we were in the training room, I was getting ready for the game, Derek was getting his ankles taped, and he said something to me and I kind of snapped at him a little bit. I snapped back. My response was very, you know, quick and harsh and defensive. And he said, "Hey, is everything all right? You know, you're being a little defensive there." And I didn't like his vibe right there. So later we actually started to converse, and he's like, "Hey, I want to tell you something." I said, "What's that?" And he said, "You know, defensiveness is actually the result of insecurity. It's caused by you being insecure. And it's not always as the whole person, but maybe there was that instance or that topic or something, you know what I mean? That you were a little bit insecure on." So I think he may have been questioning my training or something like that at the time. And I was very defensive with him. And it was great because, you know, we got to work through that together. And I always say that's what makes him such a great guy and a great leader, is that he'd never call you out in front of a group, but he always had the ability to help you see something and then work through it with you through conversation. And you know, for me, I'm the coach. I'm supposed to be helping him. But that's why I always say we all need a coach in life, and we can all use another set of eyes and another set of ears on our day-to-day performance. And, you know, sometimes too, you know, with fatigue and travel and irritability takes place, and, you know, we're not always able to fully self-assess ourselves to the best of our ability. Like I said, I've always been really good at it. In that moment, it was the playoffs. There was a lot going on. And, you know, he got the best of me in that moment. But at the end of the day, he taught me a great lesson. And, you know, that lesson was I had a little bit of work to do on myself. So
how can leaders recover from moments like those where, say, travel, fatigue, things aren't going well in the office, we have some friction with our staff, the other leaders on our team, and we do snap back. It's a harsh word or it's a disrespectful tone. And then we realize, okay, yeah, I messed up. I really messed that thing up. How can we recover from that point and not lose our leadership?
Yeah, I think the first thing you do is you admit it. You know, after you realize you messed up, you admit it. You know, you talk to the person, you have a heart-to-heart conversation. Say, "Listen, you know what? I'm a leader here, but I deal with a lot of the same things you do. You know, I deal with fatigue. I deal with, you know, times where I have to question myself and my calls and the plays that I'm calling. And sometimes I'm irritable." And, you know, nobody could ever fault you for that or go against you if that's the case. You know, you're being honest. You admitted to not handling that situation to the best of your ability. And I've even seen some leaders that say, "You know what? I don't care. Deal with it. I'm the leader here. This is my house. If you don't like it, leave. This is just how I am." I've seen both types of leadership, and both work. It's, you know, the guy that says, "Hey, you know, this is me. I lose it. And too, if you don't like it, too bad." You know, I've seen those guys go on and create billion-dollar companies. Mm-hmm. And same is true on the other side. So it's really just whatever your leadership style is. And, you know, you own it and you go with it. I'm more of the type of person, I like to clear the air mm-hmm. and make sure that everybody's on the same page. And listen, if I had a weak moment, I had a weak moment, and I got to share it with you. And let's go get after it now. You know, the air is clear. And if you ever have a weak moment, I expect you to do the same for me, to me, you know, have that conversation, and we keep the line moving.
Yeah, it seems like that would create a very warm and friendly, affable culture in the locker room, in the dugout, and beyond. Well, speaking of culture, what does it take to build a championship culture? You know, the subtitle of your book is "Nobody Becomes a Champion by Accident." What has to be happening in an environment, in an organization, between the players and the key stakeholders to build a championship environment?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of different things. I think guys just want to know that they could trust one another and that everybody's got each other's back. That's the big thing. I know, there's a lot of talk in the leadership world about, you know, just love each other and just hug it out and it's going to be great. And, you know, I got to tell you, when we won in 2009, I mean, there were times where guys were ready to fight each other. There were times when guys would air it out, and there wasn't a lot of love in the room. What happened, though, over time was guys started to pick each other up on the field. One guy didn't get it done, the next guy would, and vice versa. And that over 162 in terms of the games, and then that each time that happened, it brought everybody closer together. But, you know, I got to say, you know, in winning that year, we had a lot of fun together. But it was business, you know. Everybody came to do their job. They didn't need the validation from another person, or they didn't need the coach to, you know. It's just guys came with an attitude of, "Hey, I'm coming out to win today. I'm gonna go do my best today, and I'm gonna try to help this team win." You know. And the other thing is too, you know, we had a very clear goal and very clear objective, and it was super clear. It wasn't get to the playoffs. It wasn't win X amount of games. It was win the World Series. That was it. Anything shy of that was a failure. And that's what I appreciate about the Yankee organization, is that it's black and white, man. There is no, "Oh, we got to the ALDS. Oh, we got to the Championship Series." If you lost in either of those playoff experiences, you were a loser. And it was that simple, and it was that clear, and it wasn't, "Well, we almost got," nah. We lost, and we have to go home, and we have to be pissed off for a couple days about that, and then we have to think about how we're going to get better next year. And that was what was so great about that organization, and what's still great. You know, it's like you play with a chip on your shoulder, and you play to win, and if you come up short, you know, people are pissed, and it's and you feel that, and that's what the culture is there. So, you know. That's, I think, what keeps everybody hungry.
For those of us listening to the podcast who are not completely familiar with what a director of performance for a baseball team does, kind of break down the role that you have, the responsibility. I love how you describe it in the book as, you know, being responsible for all of this human capital.
Yeah.
Break down for us what a director of performance does and how it contributes to the culture of a team.
Yeah, so I say that I'm a human asset manager of about $300 million in human capital. So the Steinbrenner family brings me in to oversee their assets and make sure that their assets are performing at the highest possible level each and every day. So that was really what I did. So for me, my job was to assess and analyze every single player in terms of their physicality and mentality. Break them down, see where they have, you know, restrictions in their body in terms of joint range of motion, postural issues, injury histories, and all that, and then create customized plans and programs to make sure that we're ensuring that asset and lowering our injury risk and lowering our overall liability. So that's what I did, was, you know, find players, see what their weaknesses are, correct the weaknesses through programming, and then manage those weaknesses while developing strengths throughout the season. That's what I had to do. And that's not just for the physical, but it's also overseeing, you know, what they're putting in their mouths, overseeing like nutrition and diet. And then also being very aware of what they need as an individual in terms of their mindset and their attitude, making sure that they're recovering after the games, giving them recovery strategies and things like that. So doing that at the major league level and then working with a great staff in the minor league level to help implement that vision. That's what I was fortunate enough to do. And, you know, we spent a lot of time with these guys, 9 months a year. So I had 9 months out of the year to positively impact and influence them to take care of themselves at the highest possible level. So that's in a nutshell what I was responsible for each and every day.
This professional sports environment, you're with them 9 months out of the year. What's your advice for leaders in walking maybe that line between the professional and the personal? I'm sure because of the proximity between you and the players, you hear about their life and some of their challenges. But what advice can you give to especially younger leaders of having maybe an interest but not going too far, not crossing any ethical lines? Yeah. In professional environments and keeping things professional while you still do have a concern for the personal lives of your team?
Yeah, you know, at the end of the day, it all comes down to it's really business. And unfortunately, a lot of these relationships are transactional. You know, in addition to, working with the professional team, I've also run several businesses and I've had a lot of employees. And, you know, I used to do the retreats every year. I used to do the holiday bonuses. And I used to do all of these different things to show that I cared. In addition to telling them that I care, you know, and sitting with them and having conversations and taking, you know, employees to lunch one at a time to understand what their needs are and where they're at. And listen, you know what? People still left me. People still stole from me. People still took advantage of that. And what I learned is, listen, I'm always going to be that person. I'm always that. That's who I am. I like to know people as an individual. And there is a risk that people are going to burn you. And you have to accept that. And you got to understand that it's business. It's business. So you have to make the choice as a leader. Am I somebody that cares about the people that work for me at a deeper level where I want to get to know them regardless of what happens? Or am I the type of leader that says, listen, these people just work for me. You know, I take care of them the best I can. I try to create the best work environment for them. But at the end of the day, they're going to leave at some point. Some are going to stay, but at the end of the day, it's business. And I have clients that I work with that are super high net worth that run gigantic companies, and their employees are commodities. You know, they're like chess pieces, and that's the result of them getting too deep with clients without employees early. And they said, you know what? I didn't see a return on my time investment in actually caring about the day-to-day lives of these people. So I am at a point now where I use them to reach my goals, and I hope along the way they can meet theirs. Mm-hmm. And if at any point they feel like they can't, they could leave. And we hire new people. So it's business, you know. And as I'm going through, my journey in coaching a lot of CEOs, leaders, executives, you know, I don't know if I'm a fan of the ping pong table in the office and the, you know, try to make work fun. You know, it's business, man. It's like we got to go out and compete. When you show up at 9 o'clock and you leave at 5 or whatever your schedule is, you're there to win. You want to have fun? You have a weekend to have fun. You have all the time after work to have fun. But listen, losing is not fun. You know, so, I mean, if you can create a thriving culture and have all those, like I said, fun things and your team is winning, that works for you guys. But that doesn't mean it's a one-size-fits-all formula, you know. And I see a lot of companies today trying really hard to be cool and to be fun. And it's almost like they're willing to sacrifice their bottom line for that. And that's scary in itself because eventually it creates a resentful culture. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about how, you know, you were working, you were working for free. There were times you were broke, but this was a passion of yours. There's something about, and I don't know if it's a generational thing, but the more modern we get, the more we become self-aware. There seems to be this instant demand to be paid for what we want to do or for what our passions are. What's the value, or do you see any value today of still that volunteerism, that working for free as you're working toward your dream And how can you do that without being taken advantage of?
Yeah, I think, well, first is you got to know your self-worth, and you also have to know where you're at on the continuum. You know, so if you're just starting out and you don't have enough experience, you should be working for free. I mean, I still do some things for free for different reasons, but, you know, I show up, I do some things for free if it fits my overall objectives, and I go out there and I give it all I got. But you have to know where you're at in your cycle. And if you're just starting out, like, you better be out there doing whatever it takes. You have to build your Rolodex. You need to build your network. You need to build your experiences. And at the end of the day, I mean, I see a lot of people out there that want to get paid, and I don't know what you would pay them for. They don't have any skills. Mm-hmm. They don't have the depth. So I'm paying you, but I'm not getting a return on my time for paying you. So I'd rather you know what I mean? And the other thing that working for free allows is it gets you opportunities that you would not have had. You know, you're volunteering, you're giving of yourself, you're being very selfless in that nature. And if you're there and volunteering and you're hungry and you're excited and you're passionate to learn, I mean, eventually you're going to get where you need to go. And, there's some great stories on that are out there. And, there's one story about, that I enjoy, and I laugh about it. There's a woman and her daughter, you know, walking around a city one day, and they see this guy painting, and they say, "Hey, can you paint a picture of me and my daughter?" And the guy, you know, in a few minutes paints the picture of her and her daughter. And he said, it took him about 3 minutes. And he said, "That'll be about $30,000. It turns out the guy was Picasso. And she said, "Hey, that took you 3 minutes." And he said, "No, it took me 30 years. You know, and it's a simple story. I probably butchered it, but when you think about it, it's like it's a lifetime. It's a life's work. It's not, stop trying to get everything today. It's what you do over a lifetime. You know, I can charge what I charge today because of that free work I did back in the year 2000. All those volunteer hours, all of those volunteer experiences, all those conversations of, "Hey, can I take you to lunch and learn from you?" And all those people that said yes to me helped me along the way. And I still talk with them today. And I am so grateful for people that said yes to me and gave me a shot, even if it was for free, when I really had nothing to offer them. So that's the way I approach my business and I approach my life is, listen, I'm going to keep giving. I'm going to keep showing up. And I'm going to keep adding to my toolbox. And I'm going to give as much as I can. And you have to do that. And I see people coming out of school today that don't want to put the time in. And I'm like, if I had to put the time in and I got to the top of my field and you don't want to put the time in, what is there's a disconnect there. There's a gap. That's why I don't believe in paid internships. Mm. I want to see you sweat. I want to see you, you know, figure out how you're going to make it in this world. I don't care if you have to tend bar, you know, you have to bus tables. I worked at Busch Gardens in college on the back of a tram welcoming people to the amusement park. You think I wanted to be there? I didn't. But you know what? I had to be there because I had no money. I had a bicycle. I didn't have a car. And I dealt with it. I rode my bike in the rain. I got my butt kicked more days than I actually got to hold a trophy over my head. So I don't have any sympathy for people that don't want to put the time in.
Coach, you put the time in to write this book. Why is this book important, not just for seasoned leaders, but for emerging leaders, for young leaders starting out? Why should they read Habits of a Champion?
Yeah, this book took me probably over 500 hours, you know, from start to finish. So I put a lot of time in. I put a lot of effort. And I've been on a book tour now. I'm doing all the signings. And the one question I always get is, why did you write the book? And I always started off and I said, you know, I had no intention to write a book. I wasn't a big reader as a kid, and I certainly didn't think I would ever write a book. But anyway, I woke up one day in March, and I wrote a book. And what inspired the book was, you know, as a coach, I learned to do a lot of reading. I also learned to do a lot of listening. And I saw this whole, like, self-help guru space, thought leadership space. And I started to look at it and take all of the information that I was taking in. And I said, you know, this is great in theory. Mm-hmm. And the reality is you don't win a war with theory. You win a war by being on the front line and taking the shots. And I would read these books and I'd feel like I was doing everything wrong and that I was so far away from making it. And in my own right, I already made it. And I didn't do the things that were in the book. So I said, all right, something's off here. Mm-hmm. So what I started to do was really take a deep look and a deep dive into the champions that I was fortunate enough and am still fortunate enough to work with. You know, guys like Jeter, guys like A-Rod, and titans in the world of business that no one even knows because they don't care about getting their name and their image out there. They're just brilliant at what they do. So I included some of them in the book as well. And I said, my objective with this book is really simple. I want coaches, I want athletes, I want leaders, I want entrepreneurs to have a simple, easy to read resource that they could open up at any page, any chapter, and get a lesson from there. And something that they could apply immediately. But most importantly, it was a book that said, you know what? I'm not that far off. If I do a couple little things and I model some positive behaviors, I'm going to be right where I need to be. And achieving whatever it is I want to achieve is within me. It's within my abilities. It's within my capabilities. And I don't need some guru to tell me that I can make it or not. I know that I can. So I wanted the book to reinforce that can-do attitude for people. But I also wanted it to reinforce that you're not that far away, and none of us are. It's the little things. It's cleaning up your thought process. And whenever I sign a book for somebody, I write one thing that's very important. Run your own race. And that's what I wanted people to understand. I had no business being in the position I was in at 19 years old as an intern and 23 years old as the head guy with the Yankees, telling guys like Jeter and Pettit and multimillionaires what to do while I was riding my bicycle to the stadium. I was not in, but I made it happen and I didn't doubt myself and I went after it. And that's what I wanted people to gain from this book. Not how can I be like Coach Dana Cavalier, but how can I be the best me and not doubt myself and go after it?
Coach, man, great advice, great insight. I just have this picture in my mind of you riding your bike to the stadium and being and talking to some of the top athletes in the world. And I love your story. It underscores the idea that our excuses are trash. We have no excuse. If we put the work in, we can be successful. Coach, this is shameless plug time. How do we keep up with you? Website, social? How do we find out more about your work?
Yeah, so you can go on danacavalia.com, or anybody can go there. And I do a daily blog every day just about leadership, but it's in my own voice. I write it, and it's just straightforward and honest. I'm on Twitter, which, you know, I'm somewhat new to, Dana Cavalia, and Instagram, The Real Coach D. And, you know, I run all my own accounts. So it's what you see is what you get. So I love coaching people and helping them get to their next place. You know, some people I start working with them to improve their physicality, and that makes them better leaders. And, you know, that's really what I'm about. You know, I want everyone to feel empowered and strong and confident that they can achieve whatever it is they want to achieve in a no fluff environment.
My guest today has been Coach Dana Cavalier, author of Habits of a Champion, Nobody Becomes a Champion by Accident, former director of performance for the world champion New York Yankees, and former Busch Gardens employee. Coach, thanks for joining me today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
It was a great conversation with Coach Dana Cavalier about his book, Habits of a Champion, Nobody Becomes a Champion by Accident, and what it takes to foster a winning culture, a championship culture. You might have to go back and listen again and take some more notes on that conversation. Put Coach's information in the show notes so you can get your own copy of Habits of a Champion. Want to invite you to hop over to prcquinn.com, join the leaders list, take the free leadership course, and sign up for my leadership intensive. Want to put all the tools in your toolbox to help you grow as a leader. Hey, that's all I got for this episode. So until next time, take care and God bless.